Good evening and welcome to Building Bridges, your community and labor report. Tonight, our Building Bridges special, I'm Amy Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. The Corporation, the Pathological Pursuit of Profit and Power, which is a new film which analyzes the curious history, inner workings, and controversial impact of corporations upon world affairs, the environment, the gap between the world's rich and poor, and the privatization of world's resources. And we have the author of The Corporation, Joel Bacon, and director, Mark Akbar.
Well, you know, Ken, we are previewing this film at a very interesting and important point. I was in a venue that we all had been to see Fahrenheit 9/11 and spent the rest of the evening deeply immersed in a discussion of the film. And the common denominator by the end of the evening was that people had felt very enriched and were energized in the anti-Bush sentiment and message of the extraordinary film phenomena, to see a progressive film of this sort become the number one box office hit in the country, and that is Fahrenheit 9/11. And I'm very glad that this may kick open the door for other progressive filmmakers, not the least of which is this very important film that has just opened called The Corporation.
Which really lays open the question of what the corporation is and is it necessary?
And also how it controls. And it's an interesting collaboration of a very accomplished cinematographer with an economist writer. So the coming together of the economist and the book, The Corporation, and transforming it, in a manner of speaking, into film, in this instance, winds up to be a very happy marrying of two different disciplines.
And we start off with a clip from the film.
And we are going to go to, thereafter, the interview with Joel Bacon and director Mark Akbar, The Corporation, another film that offers some very important and interesting revelations about corporate control.
...150 years ago, the business corporation was a relatively insignificant institution. Today, it is all-pervasive, like the church, the monarchy, and the Communist Party in other times and places. The corporation is today's dominant institution. This documentary examines the nature, evolution, impacts, and possible futures of the modern business corporation.
I still happen to think the United States is the greatest place in the world to invest. We have some shakeups that are going on because of a few bad apples.
I still taste sweet. Some people call me a bad apple, but I may be the sweetest apple on the tree.
These are not just a bunch of bad apples.
This is just a few bad apples.
It's not just a few bad apples.
We've got to get rid of the bad apples. You can start with Tyco.
Bad apples.
We know all about WorldCom.
Bad apples.
Xerox Corporation.
Bad apples.
Arthur Anderson.
Bad apples.
Enron, obviously.
Bad apples.
Kmart Corporation.
The fruit cart is getting a little more full.
I don't think it's just a few apples, unfortunately. I think this is the worst crisis of confidence in business.
What's wrong with this picture? Can't we pick a better metaphor to describe the dominant institution of our time? Through the voices of CEOs, whistleblowers, brokers, gurus and spies, insiders and outsiders, we present the corporation as a paradox, an institution that creates great wealth but causes enormous and often hidden harms.
You know, if I had asked many people after they saw the film from the anti-globalization movement, what they might take with them if they were stranded on a desert island that would kind of fortify and renew them and continue their to fortify their convictions. I dare say they'd say the film The Corporation. It really does seem to be an encyclopedia of knowledge and information about what corporations are and the destruction that they have perpetrated on the communities of the world. Was that the intent, to be an all-encompassing look and critique at corporations? It would certainly appear to be. And I don't know if Joel wants to take that or...
We can both speak to it. This is Mark Akbar. You know, the film, as encompassing as it feels, you know, it's really more, it's trying to be more symbolic, I think, than definitive in the examples that it gives, you know, because you can open the newspaper any day of the week and you could pick 25 stories that would illuminate the nature of the modern business corporation as effectively as the examples that we happen to have chosen in the film. You know, that's one of the things that we had to confront in making the film is how, you know, to make a film about the corporation is to make a film about the world today. It's an enormous topic, and so you hone in on particular issues that stand in for a whole realm of corporate harms. And we even use this kind of graphic device that you might recall in the film, a sort of a checkerboard of little scenes, and a sort of a computer selector moves over them and then zooms in on one, and you're in some realm of, you know, harms to animals or harms to workers or harms to the biosphere. And within that, there are subcategories that you kind of scan by, and you see topics that we sort of could have covered, but, well, we're not going to go in there just today. We're going to go into this other topic here. And that's how we tried to come to terms with it in the film, in just giving these kind of symbolic examples.
I mean, I was just going to add another reason, I suppose, or the main reason why we made this film and why I think it does have the kind of resonance that you describe in terms of, you know, this would be what an anti-globalization place would take to a desert island. It began to appear, I think, in the mid-1990s that the corporation was emerging as something other than just an economic institution, that it was actually emerging as a governing institution in the world. And I think that that is a lot of the animus behind the anti-globalization movement. It's the sense that we're not up against just an institution that's governed by us. This is an institution that's now governing us. And if it is a governing institution, we need to know why it works, how it works, what makes it tick. And we don't. We tend to be quite ignorant, actually, about what the institutional characteristics are of the corporation. We think about corporations. We think about the company that made our shoes or made our computer. But we don't think about the corporation as an institution. And so in a way, this project is an attempt to reveal something that I think is almost like a Masonic secret among lawyers and economists, which is that contrary to the PR images that we get about corporations, about how they care about us and how they want to do good things in the world. Contrary to that, the institution of the corporation is legally compelled always to serve its own self-interest. And in doing that, to sacrifice the public interest, to sacrifice the environmental interest, basically to exploit whatever it can, however much it can, in order to put money in the pockets of shareholders.
What is a corporation?
It is, under the law, a legal person.
These are a special kind of persons who have no moral conscience, designed by law to be concerned only for their stockholders.
I just can't be personally responsible.
Maybe you'd better incorporate.
There are companies that make our lives better, and that's a good thing. The problem comes in the profit motivation.
Liz Claiborne jackets, $178, and the workers were paid 74 cents.
Nike assigns a time frame, 6.6 minutes to make the shirt. That means the wages come to 0.3% of the retail price.
Of course they make a profit, and it's a good thing.
In our search for wealth and for prosperity, we create a thing that's going to destroy us.
I never gave a thought to what we were taking from the earth. I didn't have an environmental vision.
Endeavor station, there is opportunity.
When the September 11th situation happened, the first thing you thought about was, well, how much is gold up?
You can manipulate consumers. Is it ethical? I don't know. But our goal is to move products.
It's always going to be there, so you may as well have faith in it.
There are those who intend that one day everything will be owned by somebody.
Within less than 10 years, a handful of global companies will own directly or through license the actual genes that make up the evolution of our species.
I said, you know, this is news. This is stuff people need to know. And he said, we just paid $3 billion for these television stations. The news is what we say it is.
Capitalism today commands the towering heights and has displaced politics and politicians as the new high priests and reigning oligarchs of our system.
Does there need to be some measure of accountability?
Yes.
And I think the business community recognizes that.
Okay, guys, enough bullshit.
Let's just follow up on that. What does differentiate a corporation from other forms of business institutions?
You know, there are many ways to organize a business. And you can organize a business as a partnership. You can organize a business as a co-op. You can organize a business as a single trader. When you organize a business as a corporation, and in particular a publicly traded corporation, the law creates certain kinds of privileges and rights for that entity that other forms of business do not have. One thing that the law does is it says that that entity is now a person. It treats it as a single person and recognizes and imposes liabilities and rights on that person rather than the real people who own it and run it. Another thing that the law does is it says that that entity has what's called limited liability. And what that means is that the people who own the company aren't held liable for the bad things that happen on account of the company's actions. And the third thing, and I think perhaps most important, is that the law imposes an obligation on the managers and directors of that company always to put the interest of the shareholders above everything else. So they are compelled to do things that will be in the interest of the shareholders, even if those things harm other kinds of interests, like environmental interests or like the interests of workers within the company.
Joel, you brought it up, but I'd certainly like Mark as well to comment on it. The coalescence or the relationship between the contemporary nation state and corporations. Certainly many of the younger people in the anti-globalization movement would seem to believe that corporations exist as an entity unto themselves that literally control the world and that there's no correlation or need or the nation state no longer has a controlling function. And I was wondering if you could just develop that a little bit.
I think it's wrong. I think there that the nation state has no controlling function. And I think it's one of the big mistakes that's being made within certain sectors of the anti-globalization movement. There is this idea that the nation state is no longer relevant. We should just bypass it. We should operate through non-governmental organizations. We should even create alliances between non-governmental organizations and corporations that want to do good. But basically, a nation state is no longer really a relevant site for political action. I think this is very wrong because this notion that the right often puts out that we're moving towards a world of sort of a more minimal state, that we're rolling back the power of the state, is absolutely wrong and inaccurate. Capital can't function without the state. Corporations are made by the state. The property rights that they enjoy and use are made by the state. So are the contract rights. So are the international agreements that give them all kinds of license in the world to move around freely and drive the regulatory standards down. So the corporate capitalism requires a huge intervention of the state. It requires the police forces to protect their property rights. It requires armies. It requires prisons, a judicial system, huge intervention by the state. What is going on now is not that the state is drawing back in any way with economic globalization, but the state is shifting its power and authority behind one set of interests and away from another. It's shifting its power and authority behind capital, behind corporations, and deregulating the various kinds of laws that are put in place to protect the public interest. So it's not that the state's retreating. It's that the state is simply moving in terms of whose powers it's aligned with. And what that suggests to me is that as political actors, we have to be acting as citizens, not just as consumers or shareholders or out in the streets or in non-governmental organizations. We have to try to reclaim our governments and rechannel their efforts and their powers into constraining capital rather than simply granting it license and facilitating its courses of action.
Mark, before we get into further into the nature of the corporation and how this beast operates and how we tame it, how do you visualize this on film?
Well, that's was certainly one of the essential challenges. You know, we gathered about 450 hours of material that we shot. We did 70 interviews, and we gathered all kinds of archival material from over 100 sources. And Jennifer Abbott, who edited the film, was quite determined to start with the text. And so we had 800 pages of transcripts that she and I both went through and highlight our favorite bits. And she worked for a very long time trying to come up with the essential filmic structure. We had the kind of conceptual structure that Joel Bakken had laid out in his many, many written and rewritten treatments. This was formed the basis of his book, which evolved in parallel with the film over the period of 6 years. So we had a lot of points that we knew we wanted to make and subjects that we wanted to explore, and then it was a question of making that real in the editing process. And so it started as texts and a lot of talking heads, and from there we built layer upon layer of visual imagery, trying to bring the film to life and make it really watchable and accessible and hopefully clear in the points that it makes.
Just give me one or two examples of the visual imagery that you're talking about.
Well, we use a lot of metaphors. You know, in the film, in fact, we got all the CEOs and critics as well. The film splits about evenly between sort of corporate insiders, there's about 20 of those, and about corporate critics and people who've been adversely affected by corporations. We asked everybody for their favorite metaphor for the corporation, and it became kind of a Rorschach test. It was interesting, you know. The sort of pro-corporate insiders had these sort of glowing images of, you know, families working together to help one another, or football teams all working towards a common
Pfizer
goal.
Pfizer was one of my favorites.
And, you know, a jigsaw puzzle where it's, you know, the corporation is just part of it, but it's not the whole thing. And, of course, the critics come along, and they're seeing fire-breathing monsters just ready to crush anything in their way, a Frankensteinian kind of creation that's sort of come back to destroy its creator. And so we dug into some fantastic archives to bring these kinds of images to life.
You know, really, the Pfizer was such a wonderful example. It reminded me of some, of course, the techniques almost used by Michael Moore, even though that wasn't the intention.
Mm-hmm.
The man is so ludicrous and comical and absurd and chauvinizing in his response as he extols the virtues of a safe subway system where they prevent fare jumping by putting in various digitalized devices, but to capture fare beaters and prevent them.
Corporations don't advertise products particularly. They're advertising a way of life, a way of thinking, you know, a story of, you know, who we are as people and how we got here and what's the source of our so-called liberty and our so-called freedom. You know, so you have decades and decades and decades of propaganda and education teaching us to think in a certain way. When applied to the large corporation, it's that the corporation was inevitable, that it's indispensable, that it somehow is remarkably efficient, and that it is responsible for progress and a good life.
I help corporations have a voice. And I help corporations share the point of view about how they feel about things.
They're selling themselves. They're selling their domination. They're selling their rule. And they're creating an image for themselves as just regular folks down the block.
Hi, how you all doing today? Good to see you. How are you doing today? Hi, how you doing today? We're from Pfizer. We're your neighbors. You're in the new houses? Are you in the new houses? Oh, these are some neighbors. Well, can we say hello? Can we say hello just for a minute? So, what do you think of the neighborhood now?
It's all right. It's good.
Yeah, I think it's been getting better over the last 20 years that I've been coming here. Yeah. So I think together, you know, working with you and Pfizer and our other partnership will make this a better place. Okay. Nice to see you, Ms. Frazier. Bye. There used to be a lot of crime at this subway. One night as I was going home, I got caught and was almost mugged. And so we decided to make a change to make this community better. We're looking at turnstiles that prevent fare beating. It used to be that you could just hop right over. So Pfizer, in collaboration with the Transit Authority, actually purchased these machines. This is a talkback box that allows us to speak to the Pfizer guard, which is approximately 500 yards from here. Now, I haven't seen the Pfizer guard today, but I'm going to see if I can call him. If he's not, I'll have to go wake him up. Hello, hello, Tom Klein speaking. So I'm sure before we're through, he'll call back. But particularly on the off hours, this allows a passenger to call directly to the Pfizer desk for assistance. And then the Pfizer guard calls the transit police, and the transit police respond to any crime situation. As a result of all this, crime is down in this station. It's much safer for our community partners. Thank you. Press the other button just to be sure. Tom speaking. Hello. We'll stop over and see him personally.
One of my favorite images is I did an interview with Milton Friedman for the film, not a known sort of anti-globalization activist type. And he's explaining the concept of externalities, which is this very sort of cool economic term to describe all of the sort of pillaging and horrors that corporations create in the world. And an externality is something that happens to some third party who isn't involved in the corporation, like, you know, getting killed or maimed or having their stream polluted or whatever. And so he's sort of talking about the externality as something that happens to a third party. And the clip is this old clip of, I'm not sure who it is, but of one person throwing a pie at another person, missing that person, and hitting a bystander. And it works very effectively to get at this idea that, mm-hmm. you know, you have these effects that are happening to people who are entirely innocent bystanders.
I like that clip because then the bystander actually goes back and fights, though.
And the metaphor there, of course, is that we can overcome this.
An externality is the effect of a transaction between two individuals and a third party who has not consented to or played any role in the carrying out of that transaction. And there are real problems in that area, there's no doubt about it.
Running a business is a tough proposition. There are costs to be minimized at every turn. And at some point, the corporation says, you know, let somebody else deal with that. Let's let somebody else supply the military power to the Middle East to protect the oil at its source. Let's let somebody else build the roads that we can drive these automobiles on. Let's let somebody else have those problems. And that is where externalities come from, that notion of let somebody else deal with that. I got all I can handle myself.
A corporation is an externalizing machine in the same way that a shark is a killing machine. Each one is designed in a very efficient way to accomplish particular objectives. In the achievement of those objectives, there isn't any question of malevolence or of will. The enterprise has within it, and the shark has within it, those characteristics that enable it to do that for which it was designed.
So the pressure's on the corporation to deliver results now and to externalize any cost that this unwary or uncaring public will allow it to externalize.
But there's so many examples of that in the film, and one of the things that is remarkable to me is the making of political films. There certainly is not the capital available that there should be for the creativity, for the insightfulness that goes into a film such as The Corporation. And I was interested in some of the endeavors that went into making a film like this on a minimal budget, and yet it is so comprehensive and expansive and multi-continental that I'm just quite amazed by the accomplishment.
Yeah, well, the human capital is out there. Know. It's the
yes.
financial resources that are a little
exactly
harder
in
to,
contradiction to the corporations. Our biggest resource is people, and theirs is profit.
Well, you know, we come from another planet, Joel and Jennifer and I, and it's called Canada. And there's a very different sort of a sense of gravity there, I think. There's a very different economic system. It's a very different society. And one of the traditions that Canada has had is to try to kind of protect its culture from the, you know, overwhelming dominance of United States cultural creations in the media. And to offset that somewhat, we have institutions, funding institutions and cultural institutions that are set up to, as a kind of bulwark against this sort of cultural hegemony sort of mm-hmm. constantly being beamed at us. Canadian feature films take up like 1% of screen time on our own movie screens in our own country. And I think it's been reported to me that in the first quarter of 2004, that doubled from 1% to 2%, and that was attributed to the popularity of The Corporation, which is now the most successful feature documentary in Canadian history. And so we have publicly funded institutions that we can approach. I mean, it's not like it's a simple. It's not like mm-hmm. you just go in and they hand you a check. I mean, it took 3.5 years of struggle and convincing and cajoling to get this film finally funded in a complicated arrangement of 15 different funders, both public and private, but mostly about 80% from taxpayer money. Thank God for that. So it took a long time. It wasn't simple, but at least it's possible. You know, our when I talk to filmmaker friends in the United States, they ask, well, and what other work do you do? It's simply assumed that you have another job to support your filmmaking
Precisely.
Habit.
We are jealous. There's no question. Yeah. And rightfully so, not to mention the single-payer system in Canada.
But. Yeah, well, it's something we're defending now against, you know, privatization schemes that are, they're barking at the heels of our system for sure. And we're trying to defend it as best we can.
Well, I mean, this is a certain welcome dose of reality from Canada, and I think we tend to ignore the wisdom that comes from Canada and the United States quite a bit. So I'd like to get back to Joel with some more probity about the essence of the film in terms of one of the most interesting things I felt in the film was that it calls into the question the actual existence of the corporation, that it hasn't been here forever, that it's something that we assume without thinking about it, but that things could be different, that things could change. And it doesn't really indicate how that's going to happen, but it makes us think about it. So do you want to maybe talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. There's a fancy word in the world of academia called reification. What that word means is that something which is human artifact starts to seem as though it's natural and inevitable. That's what reification means. And I think that we have reified the corporation in the sense that in our imaginations, it's something that seems that it's always been there, that it couldn't be otherwise, and that it's effectively a part of nature rather than a human artifact. And one of the really important messages in the film and in the book is that we created this thing. We instilled it with certain operating principles, and we can change it. We can change it. We can destroy it. The corporation, though it manifests itself in buildings and all of these things that seem very concrete, the corporation is actually nothing other than and more than a piece of paper sitting in a corporate registry somewhere that's authorized by an act of law and that's reinforced by judicial decisions and legislative decisions. So it's entirely a human artifact. And what that means is, like other human artifacts, it can be different. and we can respond to it differently. It's entirely within our sovereign power as a people to do what we want with this institution. And I think it's very important to recognize that the modern corporation is really a product of only the last century and a half, and that the original purpose behind creating the corporation was that it would serve the public good. And there's absolutely no other justification for a government to create and continue to nurture an institution than that it serves the public good. And so the public good should really be the standard for how we assess the performance of corporations. And clearly, the way they're performing in today's world suggests there's much to be desired.
The film for me is almost a prima in understanding, and it's remarkable how beautifully the film flows as a history, the history, in effect, of corporations. It really does something quite wonderful, and that is it helps create a movement. It's really a catalyst. Not that there isn't an anti-corporatist movement, but this seems to me to be a catalyst spurring a more prolific expression in society that makes us demand through activism the reclamation of our resources and the supremacy of human rights over corporate rights. And I just felt that that was done in such a splendid, such a creative way. And I, of course, that could not have just been a circumstance or a happenstance of the film. Obviously, Mark, there's an inclination on your part to have this as a service of movement creation, isn't there? Not to mention the shirt that you're wearing, which is beautiful.
Yeah, we're working.
You better describe the shirt.
It's a wonderful red, black, and white shirt. And the red image is, of course, a diabolical figure.
The man.
The man.
It's the man.
White man in a business suit. It's
red
great.
And black has always been like syndicalism to me, or communism.
Oh, really?
So I don't know what the
But then the man has two features that sort of one might be a self-projection.
The angelic and the diabolical.
Precisely, yeah.
But as I was indicating, certainly this must have been intended to be a complement to creating social activism around this most strategic issue of corporate dominance of the resources of the world.
Well, that's I think that's my job. Mm. It's a kind of public service calling.
Propagandist,
in a way.
Or would you object
depends
to that?
It depends how you define propaganda, you know. I mean, if it has a dishonest
–
I think if it has a dishonest manipulative intent, mm-hmm. that's a certain kind of propaganda. And I don't – obviously, that's not what we're trying to create here. But there's, you know, I do want to propagate an analysis that that I think is important and timely, and is, you know, ultimately I think hopeful in the end. The film does spend a lot of time deconstructing the problems that have arisen out of this corporate form, this pathological pursuit of profit and power. That's the subtitle of Joel's companion book. And I think, you know, if I'm not feeling in the work that I do as a filmmaker that I'm part of the solution, then, you know, then I'm part of the problem. And that's just how I contend with my own need to make this kind of work.
And Joel, it's hard to pick, and I don't really need to, which is the most searing abuse. On the other hand, the harnessing of rainwater and the privatization of that element of nature is so appalling.
The prospect that two-thirds of the world's population will have no access to fresh drinking water by 2025 has provoked the initial confrontations in a worldwide battle for control over the planet's most basic resource. When Bolivia sought to refinance the public water service of its third largest city, the World Bank required that it be privatized. which is how the Bechtel Corporation of San Francisco gained control over all of Cochabamba's water. Even that which fell from the sky. The price this beleaguered country paid for World Bank loans was the privatization of the state oil industry and its airline, railroad, electric, and phone companies. But the government failed to convince Bolivians that water is a commodity like any other.
Imágenes que reflejan definitivamente la situación que vivió Cochabamba durante la jornada de este viernes. Prácticamente estuvo sitiada. Policías del departamento.
Bolivia was determined to defend the corporation's right to charge families living on $2 a day as much as one quarter of their income for water. The greater the popular resistance to the water privatization scheme, the more violent became the standoff.
Deregulation, privatization, free trade. What we're seeing is yet another enclosure and, if you like, private taking of the commons. One of the things I find very interesting in our current debates is this concept of who creates wealth, that wealth is only created when it's owned privately. What would you call clean water, fresh air, a safe environment? Are they not a form of wealth? And why does it only become wealth when some entity puts a fence around it and declares it private property? Well, you know, that's not wealth creation, that's wealth usurpation.
Privatization does not mean you take a public institution and give it to some nice person. It means you take a public institution and give it to an unaccountable tyranny. Public institutions have many side benefits. For one thing, they may purposely run at a loss. They're not out for profit. They may purposely run at a loss because of the side benefits. So, for example, if a public steel industry runs at a loss, it's providing cheap steel to other industries. Maybe that's a good thing. Public institutions can have a countercyclic property. So that means that they can maintain employment in periods of recession, which increases demand, which helps you get out of a recession. A private company can't do that. Recession, throw out the workforce. That's where you make money.
There are those who intend that one day everything will be owned by somebody. And we're not just talking goods here. We're talking human rights, human services, essential services for life, education, public health, social assistance, pensions, housing. We're also talking about the survival of the planet, the areas that we believe must be maintained in the commons or under common control, or we will collectively die, water and air.
Is this the apex? Is this the epitome, or are there yet more abuses that can come? Privatization of fundamental natural resources.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have.
Should I be that outraged? Certainly, the people in the film were. Actually, I am that outraged.
But we had a guy, Carlton Brown, a commodities trader, who talks about how when the Twin Towers fell in 9/11, right. The first thing that he thought of, and he says, and you can be sure every other broker was thinking this, was how much is gold up? That was his first thought when the Twin Towers fell. And then he says, we had to get them out. We had to get our clients out. And he wasn't talking about getting them out of the building. He was saying he had to get them out of the gold market so that they could take their winnings. And then he says that at the end of his he says, in devastation, there is opportunity. And I think the point that we want to take from that is that in everything there's opportunity for a corporation.
I gotta be honest with you. When the September 11th situation happened, I didn't know that. And I must say, and I wanna say this because it's, I wanna take it lightly. It's not a light situation. It's a devastating act. It was really a bad thing. It was one of the worst things I've seen in my lifetime, you know. But I will tell you, and every trader will tell you, who was not in that building and who was buying gold and who owned gold and silver, that when it happened, the first thing you thought about was, well, how much is gold up?
One day early in this journey, it dawned on me that the way I've been running Interface is the way of the plunderer. Plundering something that's not mine, something that belongs to every creature on earth. And I said to myself, my goodness, the day must come when this is illegal, that when plundering is not allowed. I mean, it must come. So I said to myself, my goodness, someday people like me will end up in jail.
We asked parents to keep a diary for 3 weeks and to record every time, you could imagine, every time their child nagged them for a product. We asked them to record when, where, and why.
This study was not to help parents cope with nagging. It was to help corporations help children nag for their products more effectively.
They are tomorrow's adult consumers, so start talking with them now, build that relationship when they're younger, and you've got them as an adult. Somebody asked me, Lucy, is that ethical? You're essentially manipulating these children. Well, yeah, is it ethical? I don't know. But our role at Initiative is to move products. And if we know you move products with a certain creative execution, placed in a certain type of media vehicle, then we've done our job.
Over the past decade, we have been gaining ground. And when I say we, I mean ordinary people committed to the welfare of all of humanity. All people, irrespective of gender and class and race and religion, all species on the planet. We have overturned nearly 99% of the Basmati patent of rice tech. Again, because we worked as a worldwide coalition, old women in Texas, scientists in India, activists sitting in Vancouver, a little Basmati action group. We stopped the third world being viewed as the pirate, and we showed the corporations were the pirate.
A corporation is designed to create wealth and designed to exploit in order to create wealth. And I'm using exploit as economists use that term. So it doesn't matter what. It can be the aftermath of 9/11, or it can be rainwater, or it can be outer space. And there are people out there today, people like Milton Friedman and somebody, Michael Walker, who you see in the film, mm-hmm. who believe that the regime of private ownership and exploitation of private property should basically govern every aspect of human and social activity, that we should pull back the notion of having democratic government regulating these things and owning these things. We should lose the idea of having public parks, or of having public water bodies, or of having public rainwater, or of having public anything, public schools, public fire departments. Let's just get rid of all of that because it was a big mistake, these people say. And let's hand all of that over to for-profit corporations to administer, to govern, to deliver. That's what privatization's all about. Privatization is a dynamic. A corporation has no internal restraint on what or how much it will exploit. And so corporations have been lobbying government to reduce the public sphere so that they can go in and exploit in areas that they've been prevented by the public sphere from exploiting. And I think it's very dangerous because what we do with privatization is, whether it's rainwater or it's our public schools, we hand over to an institution that lacks the capacity to serve the public interest as an end in itself jurisdiction over the public interest.
People themselves are a means to the end, and the only end is proliferation of profit.
Exactly.
I wanted to follow up on the idea of social change that you were talking about. You were talking about it more from the corporation's point of view, and I want to turn that on its head now to talk about social change from the people's point of view. A few years ago, it seemed as if corporate heads were the heroes of the world. They were on Time magazine. They were the people of the year. And now that seems to be the other way around. But everything always seems to be natural the way it is right now. How do you see things changing? Marx couldn't predict change, so I don't expect you to predict change. But how do you see this process of change going?
Forecast change.
Yeah, well, there's always going to be change, but I mean, you have to try to figure it out.
Yeah, no, I can predict that there will be change.
However, I don't know whether
it'll be good change. this is how, I mean, when I look at history, and I'm sort of an amateur student of history, when I look at history, what I see is the rise and then the fall of great empires, of great regimes, of dominant systems. So today, you know, the Egyptian Empire isn't there anymore. The Roman Empire isn't there anymore. The Communist Party isn't really there anymore in the way that it was. The church, the monarchy, all of these dominant systems have risen to the point where they've seemed omnipotent, where it seemed impossible to change them. And yet they've all been humbled by history. Now, we now live in a dominant order where the corporation is arguably the dominant system in terms of its values, its ideology, its reach into our lives, and its dominance over our governing systems. I don't believe that the corporation is the first institution in history that's going to be immune to history's march. I think that would be I'm sure many people within the corporate sector believe this, but I think when you look at history, it's exactly at the moment when the system seems most omnipotent and most impossible to change, that all of a sudden it starts to crumble. And I don't think that's a coincidence. I think when systems become too powerful, they become arrogant and they forget that they have to legitimate themselves. And I think we're at that point now with corporate capitalism. We're at the point where I think there's a belief in the corporate sector that we are so powerful now that we are omnipotent. And I think some people within the corporate sector, like Ray Anderson, who you meet in the film, believe that this is really a bad thing for people to be thinking within the corporate system, because it could be the beginning of the end. But I don't know what the timeline is. I do know that corporate capitalism as we know it today is not going to exist at some point in the way it currently exists, but I don't know exactly when.
You also pick apart the mechanisms that entice or drag consumers into assimilating the rationalizations of goodness of corporations, and indeed certainly make us indeed consumers of the various products. One of the particular things that was very engrossing to me in the film, there were so many, but one of the things is there's this pan-in of a gentleman who is trimming shrubbery of some kind. And I expected then to be a kind of zoom out to some sort of a rose garden, or I wasn't quite sure where it was going. And what he is doing is then on what appears to be ultimately the side of a highway, this grassy knoll, and he is trimming a kind of Busby Berkeley shot from above, where you go in and you see the corporate name, one after the other, that is trimmed and carved out and spelled out in shrubbery, which was such a remarkable concept. And from there, the film goes into some discussion of public spaces and the privatization and accumulation and wresting away of public spaces. And I just thought the visuality was brilliant and so darn perverse, which really goes to your logo as well. There is that perversity, but I thought that was just tremendous, Mark.
It's nice of you to point that one out. Yeah, because we had that. We actually wrote that one, and then realized it.
Where was this?
This
area?
Is along the side of the highway on something called the Don Valley Parkway. Gardner Expressway in Toronto.
It was amazing.
And these are massive corporate logos. The ones that we did, the one that we did there was AT&T. And there's something about there's something sort of a deeper symbolism, I think, in this sort of mastery of nature to the subsuming nature to the corporate need. I think that's how that image also read to me. And then you back up and you see one after another, and as you're driving by these things, you see they're kind of these white rocks as well as trimmed little shrubs to sort of for relief, you know, so they really stand out. And then, of course, we realized then later, I think, that we were on private property and it was a little Michael Moore scene where we got thrown off.
Well, I must admit, it's important to say, while we have someone like Joel in the script, which is so full and so full-blown in its informational base, the imagery, any one vignette, similarly spells and kind of smacks you with the vulgarity and the corruption, really, of corporatization. just does.
Well, I think Jennifer did just an amazing job editing the film to have that visual but also very emotional impact. I think people come out of the film sometimes in tears, or there's certainly parts of it that are so deeply moving. And just I think it's constructed in a way – I think people – care, they really do care about the environment, but we get sort of dulled by our city lives, and I think the film and the music and the soundscape that's created in it by our friend Velcro Ripper combine to remind us on a very deep emotional level that we do care about these things. And there's something about the way the film is constructed is that it opens you to that and lets you have that experience.
It's not pedantic either, which is really nice. It's not this kind of rhetorical hitting style. There's deep information, but you kind of come along with the film, which I appreciate very much. You are obviously on a tour to present and promote the film. What has been, I know the response in Canada has been enormous. Where do you go from here? And how do you see utilizing this film as part, clearly, of the movement to humanize our society and certainly discipline those darned abusive corporations?
One of our best screenings so far in showing this film in many different places was in Salt Lake City, Utah. And we did it as a sort of throw-off from the Sundance Festival. And I was just so moved by the audience responding in the way it did there, because I thought, this isn't New York City, this isn't Boston, this isn't San Francisco, this is Salt Lake City, Utah, this is Middle America, and these people are responding. And in the Q&A after, they responded with Middle America questions, namely, how is this affecting us? What is this doing to our communities? And so I think the film is going to play not just to the already converted in urban areas, but I think it's going to play very broadly in this country.
Well, we're excited about it. It's our hope, and it's been a pleasure speaking with both of you.
Just very briefly, please check out our website, thecorporation.com, to see where and when the film is playing wherever you live.
And we thank you both very much.
This is for all you big government Wall Street types. Well, I was watching TV at election time. There were two candidates trying to lay it on the line. One of them looked like he was training to be cute. He was a white man in a business suit. I looked at the other, he was equally astute. He was a white man in a business suit. Well, they kept on talking, they didn't make sense. They both seemed to be on the same side of the fence. There was no real debate, it was a phony dispute. They were just two white men in business suits. If you want to be the president, better learn to salute and be a white man in a business suit. He's a white man in a business suit. Every single one of them are in cahoots. running the U.S., Europe, and Russia, too. He's a white man in a business suit. Well, I went to the stream to get a little drink. The water was dark and murky, and it sure did sting. I went upstream to find the source of the spill. There was a chemical plant on top of the hill. I asked for the owner of this place of ill repute. He was a white man in a business suit. He's a white man in a business suit. The profits are his, it's our world he pollutes. He'll never pay for his crimes, he's got a golden parachute. He's a white man in a business suit. Sued by a lawyer, he was after my loot. He was a white man in a business suit. I got fired by my boss cause I wouldn't lick his boots. He was a white man in a business suit. I got evicted by my landlord cause my rent was overdue. He was a white man in a business suit. I got rejected for a loan at the financial institute by a white man in a business suit. I tried talking to my congressman, he didn't give a hoot. He was a white man in a business suit. I went to see my preacher, he just asked me to contribute. He was a white man in a business suit. They finally hauled me to a shrink, he said my case was acute. He was a white man in a business suit. Well, there's a whole lot of things I'd rather do than be a white man in a business suit. I'd rather be ragged with holes in my shoes than be a white man in a business suit. Yeah!
And that's Mike Stout. We are the Human Union, and that is, hey, what else? White man in a business suit, a perfect compliment to the film The Corporation, which both Ken and I strongly recommend that you go to see.
You've been listening to Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
White man in a business suit. He wants his control to be absolute. From Exxon to Chrysler to United Fruit. He's a white man in a business suit.